Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 189 featuring Chris Nichols. And no, this isn't a trick question. Chris Nichols is not me who's being interviewed. It's actually another Chris Nichols. So Chris Nichols is interviewing Chris Nichols. He's a great artist and works at Digital Domain, and he and I actually worked at Digital Domain at the same time. It was pretty entertaining. He was in the Vancouver office and I was in the Venice office, and we would accidentally get each other's emails and mail and phone calls, so that people always confused he and I. But he is also an amazing artist, and he has a huge role to play in the look dev and general, you know, look of Thanos that happened during the new Avengers movie that came out. So we talked about him in the past when I did the podcast with Darren Handler. But I happened to be at SIGGRAPH, and I decided, hey, I should get together with Chris Nichols. This would be hilarious. This would be great. So super, super nice guy. And he and I actually, even though we don't never really work directly together or never really saw each other, we would communicate on IM all the time. And I said, let's get together. Let's do a podcast. And I thought it was a great idea. So a couple notes about that. I decided that I'm going to lighten my load on my podcast gear when I travel. And this was recorded in Vancouver at SIGGRAPH 2018. So it was a little experiment. I mean, it's not the sort of studio recording that you may know from the CG Garage. I actually took my H6 and some lavalier microphones and attached it to us, and we recorded it at the lobby bar in my hotel at SIGGRAPH. And Chris and I had a couple of old fashions and talked about the amazing work that he does. So there's a lot of ambient noise going around, but I still think it's very, very interesting to, I still think it sounds great. And I'm going to be probably, when I'm traveling, I'm probably going to do more podcasts like this. It's way more relaxing, way more, easy to go, but I'd love to hear your feedback if you guys think it was okay to have it sort of in a more open air area with a lot more noise around us. I really appreciated it. Anyway, Chris was great. I really appreciate him coming on. And Digital Domain did such an amazing job on Avengers 4 and on Thanos. I thought it was really cool to have that. All right, let's move on. A couple of announcements. About 2 days ago, there was an exhibit that opened at the A+D Museum in downtown Los Angeles, which is the Architecture and Design Museum. And we were involved in that. And Lana and I actually were personally involved in a part of it as well. And it's a really cool exhibit. It's called Wireframe, and it's going to be there till November 25th, I believe. And it is about the history of architecture visualization and computer graphics in that area. It's a really fascinating exhibit. It's anyone who's interested in architecture or computer graphics of any kind, I really think you would appreciate and understand some of those amazing things that are going on in that area. So really great to see that. That's about all I can say about that exhibit. Other announcements for Chaos Group is, obviously, we mentioned cloud before, but you guys should really check it out. There's a lot of people right now that have signed up for cloud and using our cloud points. We're giving away free cloud rendering for people on the beta so that we can really test out our system. So go ahead and take advantage of that. That's basically just, you have a free render farm. You have 1,000 credits. And if you use all your 1,000 credits and you need more, I'm sure we can probably find a way to give you more if you continue to give us really good feedback on the system. So let us know how things are going and give us your feedback. We would love to figure that out. Obviously V-Ray next for Maya is in beta, and that we need your feedback on that as well. So really like to hear that. The only other thing I can tell you about stuff going on is that there's going to be the... I'm going to be at THU at the end of September, and I will be doing some panels over there, so I'm excited about that. And I'll be meeting a lot of people there, so I'm also excited about that. And probably recording a whole bunch of podcasts, so also excited about that. All right, and I think that's all really I have for this intro. That being said, please enjoy this great podcast with Chris Nichols from Digital Domain that was recorded in Vancouver during SIGGRAPH 2018. Thanks a lot, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
This thing probably holds a lot, right? The data?
Oh yeah, it'll hold hours of
We can record for 28 hours apparently.
Oh, okay. Well, let's get some drinks and get started. It's gonna be a long night.
It's gonna be a long night. Well, we have to first tell stories about how you and I would get each other's information at DD.
Exactly. Man, the bane of my existence. I would get so excited, too, because I get all these great, like, emails and offers from people, and it'd all be for you.
Well, I also would get invites from your friends to go to lunch.
Oh, yeah? Popular guy, right?
And you were like, hey, let's go here and meet at... It's like, what, is that a new restaurant? I had no idea, and I realized, like, because I'm in Venice and you're in Vancouver, and it was a completely different thing. But yeah, we would get each other's emails a lot.
Yeah.
And I think I even got your mail a couple times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My payslip?
I think it was something like your payslip. Something from HR accidentally came to me, and I was like, wait a minute, that's not for me.
Yeah.
It was...
That's so
it was...
funny. Well, I'm sure, like, I never could figure out where they gave me my email address is Chris Nick, and it's never been that before at any other studio.
But it was
studio.
Chris Nichols, right?
No, it was just Chris Nick.
That was your email?
Yeah, it still is. And it has been for 8 years, but you got the good one, C. Nichols at D2.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But I think if you just looked up Chris Nichols,
it
would come up to you.
It may have done, right? That's what I use, Chris Nichols, but you go by Christopher.
Yeah. I did that just for, like, but most people called me Chris, too, so it was very easy. Yeah. Everyone called me,
Thank goodness we never worked in the same location.
Yeah, but it was funny that I had a confidant just because you were a really nice guy. You had the same name as me, but I've never met you, but we would, like, totally exchange these moments.
Yeah, totally.
It's pretty great. Oh, our drinks are here. Perfect.
Thanks.
All right.
Awesome.
Old fashions are delicious. Thank you so much. All right, well, cheers, man.
I'm so happy to be on this podcast. It's honestly one of my favorites.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
It's such an honor.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you've been mentioned before on the podcast.
Yeah, I guess Ron Miller and Darren Hendler.
Yeah. And you've made quite a name for yourself on this last film.
Things got pretty crazy, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's been, the last 2 years have been really interesting. Let me just put it like that.
But it's also, what's also awesome is that you're totally doing the kind of stuff that I was passionate about back then. So I really feel like
I'm carrying on the legacy.
You're carrying on the legacy of Chris Nichols in name or some kind of thing. And I'm not saying that you don't deserve your own. You are doing your own thing, and you're much. You know a lot more about textures and surfacing, etc., than I did, because I dealt a lot more with the lighting side of things in some ways.
Yeah.
But. Man, Thanos, you had a lot to do with Thanos.
You know what? I was very lucky. I got on this project very early on.
Right.
And it was just a simple test that we were trying to do for Marvel.
Uh-huh.
And it just lined up. I finished Power Rangers, just come off that show.
Oh, right.
And Darren...
Did you do that at DD?
I was.
How long have you been at DD now?
8 years.
Jesus.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a while.
Since 2010.
Wow.
So the first Thor was my first film at DD.
Mm.
And been there ever since.
Wow.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So anyway, go back to Thanos. Tell me more about how that went.
Yeah, well, so what happened is basically Marvel kind of got us to do this simple test. Well, I shouldn't say simple, but it started like he wasn't going to be such a big character, I think.
Really?
Yeah. From what I can gather, he was going to be in the film, but like it wasn't until they really could see what kind of fidelity they were getting that this Josh Brolin performance was coming through so well.
Do you think they were playing it safe? Like, we're not, because he's a CG character, we're going to make him more secondary?
I can't say for sure, but we had just great people. Like, we had Ron Miller, who was in charge of the facial stuff.
Right.
And then, obviously, Darren Hendler and Jeremy Boutel, who...
Yeah.
the experience with like Beast and Maleficent, all their creature development stuff. So like it just was such a pleasure to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And everybody that was working on it just like gave it 110%.
Right.
But we were trying to figure out what would give us the edge, you know, like what is going to make Marvel think like we should give this to DD.
And what was it?
The trick really was just trying to get as much Brolin in there as we could without it becoming too Brolin-esque. Trying to get that into Brolin, I think, into Thanos, that was really the trick.
I think that was what took me by surprise for him as a character. Because we've all seen CG characters and studied them ad nauseum, right? Like how...
Sure.
Right? One of the things that surprised me the most about Thanos as a character was how subtle things came through, right? And that is because a lot of times CG characters seem to overact to make up for the fact that you can't capture everything.
Totally,
you know what I mean?
Right? Yeah.
I'm not necessarily knocking the Andy Serkis way of thinking because I think Andy Serkis sometimes gets very exaggerated, but I think that's how he was able to convey his emotions because the CG character was not able to capture the subtleties, so he exaggerated a lot of the emotions, which was a good reaction.
Yeah.
But I think something happened, and maybe this was, you know, I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that Josh Brolin noticed how much of his emotions came through at a lower level, and he adjusted his performance.
Yeah.
To do that, right?
That was actually something that was really exciting for us, is because we put this test together. Marvel liked it so much, and before they even filmed Josh Brolin on set, they showed it to him, and he just was like, "Oh, my performance is like there. Like this, I'd have to overact it. It's not like I'm wearing prosthetics or something like that. It's a straight translation." And I think a lot of that had to do with the way that DD was doing the animation, where they were using direct drive, and it's just a technology that allowed them to get those subtleties.
Yeah, and it's going to sound weird, but I did do a stupid short with V-Ray IRL thing, right?
Yeah, I know it. I've seen that.
And I was never an actor until that specific thing, right? Yeah. And I don't know anything about acting or anything, but there was a guy, Dan Thrawn, who's been on the podcast many times. He directed it.
I love him. He's fantastic, man.
But I didn't realize how, when you have a camera right up in your face, how much you have to not overact.
Right.
Like, you actually have to be very, very low level.
Yep.
Because otherwise you just look like you're exaggerating, right?
Yeah, not theater, right?
It's not theater. Yeah. And it's actually even less than real life. Because when the camera is this close to you, you have to, like, when you're angry, you can't be like, because you just look stupid that way.
Right,
you know?
Like
that makes sense in a medium shot, but up close, it doesn't. And Thanos, you had such close-ups, and it came out really well. Now, yes, I am... We've talked a lot about direct drive. We've talked about it on different podcasts with Darren and Steph. But there was also immense amount of detail that went into the skin and the shading and the details and all of that stuff that really came through that I think were very important towards making all those things believable, right? You spend a ton of time giving him imperfections.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wanted it to be the most realistic character on screen. That was that was my personal goal. I had a pretty good idea from talking to Darren and Jeremy that they were going to put the camera really close to Thanos for long periods of time, not just grazing past him.
Right.
So I was looking into different techniques that I wanted to utilize. I hadn't quite done it yet, but I'd been sort of like getting familiar with, you know, skin scan technology, and also trying to find a better skin shader as well than what we were used to using.
Right.
So not long before I started working on this, is when the AL skin shader came out.
Oh yeah.
And I got really excited about that. I had seen so many great tests that were done in Arnold, like using that skin shader. And so when it came into V-Ray, I just never used the other skin shaders again.
It's a good shader.
I love it.
I've talked to Angers about it as well, and he's a really nice guy, and is like, I wanted, because we did a whole thing about the AL surface shader, and I wanted to give him credit and ask him if he was cool about that, and he was great.
Yeah.
The thing that's amazing to me about the AL surface shader is as you know, I've been working on the WikiHuman project, right? And so we had a WikiHuman shader that we did to dissect the ICT data and put it in. And it works really well, completely dissected. And then when I looked at the AL surface shader, I realized it's doing almost exactly everything I wanted to do with the WikiHuman shader,
right,
except that it blends, well, does one thing specifically much better, which is to blend the spec on top of the subsurface much better, so that edges of noses look perfect. Like, right, yeah, right. You know what I mean?
And the glossy Fresnel.
The glossy Fresnel comes in perfect. And GGX is a really great specular model as well.
Right. Yep.
And it just looks really good.
Yeah.
It looks really good. And it's actually not that expensive. It's a...
No, not at all. Well, the thing for me was like, I just wasn't getting these strange glows in the occluding areas.
Yeah, exactly.
Like in the inner eyelids, around the nostrils. And that was the selling point, because I had to sell this shader to Darren and Jeremy.
Yep.
And also my technique for doing skin as well, which was to use XYZ skin scans.
Explain that one.
So Jeremy Celeste, I think he used to work for Framestore at one point.
Mm-hmm.
So he left Framestore and started his own company. And what he does is he basically like captures skin pore detail, very high fidelity, but not just on a pore level, but there's three levels, like three different maps.
Yep.
And we call them primary, secondary, and tertiary. So the primary is like a larger frequency of detail, still the pore and what do you call it, like cavities, wrinkle detail, but there's a lot more larger frequencies like that actually sculpt the face.
Right.
Now the second channel, the secondary, is the same thing, but that larger frequency of detail is been cancelled out, and it's just a sharpened version of that.
Right.
And then finally the tertiary is almost like a noise. So when you use these together, when you dial them in, like in a shading network, you can essentially control the roughness of a face, which is the first. So for Thanos, I never used a gloss map. I was actually breaking up the reflective quality of the face
all through the
displacement.
That's the way it should be done.
Which is real, right?
That's right. The glossiness is actually like if I went down to infinite. Down to an atom, I could make everything a mirror.
Right. Right.
If I could displace down to that level, then I could make everything a mirror.
Sure.
So you used a single glossiness level, and then everything else, the roughness, was derived from
exactly the by modulating those frequencies of detail.
That's perfect, because that's the way we're doing it at WikiHuman as well. Because we have a 16K displacement map for his face. Right.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot of data, right?
Yeah.
So we go down to, and that's exactly what you did. But you derived the. You derived it completely as an artist interpolator, right?
Yeah.
On the WikiHuman data, we're scanning it, we know it's right, but you have to creatively think about what that is, right?
Exactly. And that was the thing, is because Thanos looks older than Josh. Like Josh Brolin is what, a man in his early 50s, maybe late 40s?
Right.
Thanos is around that age, but he's also a purple alien. And we, I'm from Titan.
Right.
So we like the things I was thinking about when I was creating his skin was like, you know, what kind of radiation is there? Like, you know, is he been out in the sun a lot? He's a warrior.
Right.
He spends a lot of time out in space as well. But, you know, I wanted to get some of those like broken blood vessels and tan and really age him to make him feel like he was an elderly gentleman.
Yeah. Well, you did that for sure. What was also... I want to get to the purple part in a second because I know that was a huge challenge.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Huge challenge. But the thing that also was amazing, and this was something that Fernando brought up in his talk today, was that you thought of everything. Like, right, there's a shot of his hand.
Yeah.
Where he's holding the little balance thing, right?
Yeah.
And
the knife.
The knife, right? But you... like made his nails a little rougher.
Yeah.
And his hand, like there was skin peeling off. Dry like, skin. He really definitely needed a manicure.
Yeah.
As do I, apparently. But it was great. Mm. And that's something that people, like a man, that, like a warrior that needs a manicure
yeah.
is not modeled at that level, right?
Yeah.
Which that's is right. awesome.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you're essentially trying to tell a story, right?
Yeah.
And you want to give him backstory through the texture. That's where your job becomes incredibly fun.
I love the fact that you bring that up because I think so many people feel... I know in visual effects it's really hard to feel part of the story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, like, as a lighter, for example, I'm you're given a shot and you have to match the lighting of the shot and you really don't have many creative decisions in some cases, right? You could feel that way, like, well, I have to match the lighting that the DP gave for the shot, and it'll look really good, but there's really no decisions that were made. When you sat there and you thought about the fingernails and the skin coming off,
yeah.
you probably in the back of your mind, you're thinking about, like, what might have happened to his hand.
Absolutely.
Right, you know?
I'm thinking about that. If you look closely,
yeah.
he's got calluses all on the underside of his palms.
Right.
Because sometimes he's holding a blade, like,
yeah.
or when he's not crushing skulls.
yeah.
yeah. And I wanted to give him that very weathered feeling. Like, this is a man who doesn't just send out troops to, like, do his bidding. He does that.
Yeah.
But he's on the ground.
He's hands on.
yeah. He likes to get down and gritty and bloody yeah. sometimes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's the thing. I was thinking of him as more of like a Roman centurion or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. a really good military leader. He's
yeah.
got a bit of hands-on experience.
Yep. yeah, no, it's really... it came through.
Yeah.
It came through. The other thing that I always... And I always feel this a little bit. Because how long were you working on that project?
I was on it for about a year and a half.
Year and a half.
Yeah,
okay.
From the beginning of the test till we delivered. So
okay.
that was a few months.
Which is actually shorter than a show like that would have thought. That's like a 2.5 year
yeah.
project usually.
Yeah.
That was so that's actually accelerated considering how detailed you went.
Mm.
But I've always noticed when I do things like that and I look at stuff like some of the stuff I did on Maleficent or things like that, there are test shots
yeah.
that you do that you feel are so much more indicative
right.
of the work you have done and showcase it more
yeah.
that it's kind of lost. Like anyone who watches the film that's kind of goes like, oh yeah, Thanos looked pretty great. He looked, but like if I saw a test shot and you guys did of just an eye motion.
Yeah, yeah.
That if anyone saw that or if something like that was in a film, it would have blown people away.
Right, yeah. We love that, Iron. Like that was the thing where we all got excited because it was just like, that's him. You know?
But that's better than even anything in a film. And not to say that the film wasn't good, but I'm just saying that the film never gave you the opportunity to see him at that level.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever regret some of that a little bit? Or you just feel like you have it in the back of your head?
What you're talking about definitely resonates.
Yeah.
I remember this on Ender's Game when I was...
Oh, yeah.
When I worked on the Queen alien.
Oh, yeah.
At the end. And I thought that the stuff that... Like, the look dev test looked so much better than what actually ended up on film.
Yeah.
But it was just to do with the compressed time and, you know, the director's got his vision of how stuff goes. But with Thanos, they gave him so much screen time.
They did give him a lot of screen time. You're not going to dismiss that. It's true. You can't really be upset about it.
Right. And they get pretty close as well.
Like, yeah. Yeah, no, really and, he, close, and he's close. Been well, like, publicized and,
yeah.
and praised across
yeah.
the industry. So.
I feel pretty satisfied. Like, when I watch the film, I don't feel like, oh, man, it kind of looked a little better in the tests or something mm-hmm. like that. Like, I think everybody worked really hard to really pull as much detail as they could out and just, you know, brought their A game with every shot pretty
yeah.
much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it was a really, really, really cool show, and I just want to make sure I tend to jump all over the map when
yeah.
I go on this
yeah,
on the
yeah.
podcast, but I want to talk about that first because it's fresh in my mind right now. I'm very excited about it because we just listened to Fernando's talk not long ago, and it was really good. And I'm still thinking about that. Part of me, I know I've left the industry in some ways, but part of me is going, that's why I liked doing what I do.
Absolutely,
and it
yeah.
was really cool, and
yeah.
it was a little bit. I mourned leaving production for a little bit because I saw the work that was being done there, and I was like, oh, it's gorgeous work, and it was really great. It was really great, and I know there's a lot of exciting stuff that you guys are still working on. Yeah. So there's more to see in this area, and I know we can't necessarily talk about some of those things, but I'm very excited about where you guys are going with Digital Humans and in that work. Mm. But let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to some of your history.
Okay.
How did you get into this? Like, what was your interest in either CG or film, or what got you into this area?
I thought I was going to grow up to be an illustrator.
Like hand illustrator?
Yeah, hand paint. Like, when I was a kid, like 10 years old, I got my first Frank Frazetta book. And that was it. Like, I just fell in love with fantasy art. And I just got as much as I could.
Okay.
A massive art book collection. And that's what I do. I just draw and paint. And I was also painting Warhammer miniatures as well.
Really?
Yeah. So this is like a primitive form of texture painting.
Yeah, with the teeny little paintbrushes?
Tiny little sable brushes. Yeah. I loved it. I bought more than I could ever paint, let's put it that way.
Nice.
But, you know, when I left high school, I went to art school, like a illustration kind of course.
And where was this?
I'm from Perth in West Australia.
Perth, yeah. Okay, Western Australia. Yeah. Which is interesting. I'm starting to get to know Australia a little bit. I've never been to Australia. But I'm starting to get to know a little bit about Australia. And Perth is a little bit out on the western side, right?
We are the most isolated city in the world.
Really?
Our closest neighbors are in Indonesia.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Jakarta is the closest city to us. Wow. So as far as Australia goes, obviously Adelaide is the next Australian city, but we are very isolated.
Interesting.
So, what really happened was, I think it was when Fellowship of the Ring came out. That was what just completely changed my life. I was seeing what Weta was doing.
And how old were you at that time?
I was about 18.
Okay.
Yeah, when Fellowship of the Ring came out.
Right, alright.
And I never touched 3D graphics before. I knew some people that knew a bit of Max, but it just seemed so out of my depth.
Right.
And I was very much interested in the analog side of things still, like painting and drawing.
Concept art.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But just seeing the cave troll and, you know, just all this great imagery, and it just blew my mind. I got the art books, and I started researching about Weta, and that was my goal. I just wanted to get there, if I could get into Weta and start
working. But were you interested specifically in, like taking the concept art and bringing it to life? Was that what was the thing? Or were you like still interested in the concept art at that point?
I very much so interested in the concept art. But then I was like also dabbling with sculpture as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, using just like water-based clay, stuff like that. Building maquettes. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I just wanted to work on creatures. It didn't really matter what it was going to be. If I was drawing them or if I was sculpting them or painting them.
Right.
And for the longest time, like, even when I started out in visual effects, I was kind of doing all of that. I was designing, modeling, texturing.
Do whatever it takes. Yeah,
whatever it takes. I just didn't know that you were kind of expected to do one thing in the industry. I just wasn't exposed to it. There was no studios.
I find that actually the industry has kind of gotten more flexible.
Yeah.
Because it used to be like, no.
Uh-huh.
You're a modeler and you only model textures.
Yeah.
Or only model, hard surface. Or you only model, like, creatures. Or it was way worse. Now, I think people have gotten a lot more flexibility in terms of stuff. Because when I knew you, you were doing a lot of textures, but now you're doing a lot more, like, surface stuff and involved in look development. And
you know what? I think DD has kind of relaxed in that regard over the last few years. Because it was, when I came to DD, I was lucky to do a bit of modeling, a bit of texturing.
Right.
Then I just went purely into texturing. But for a long time, I was trying to advocate to let the texture painters do the look dev, or at least be involved in it in some way.
It's a good idea.
And we feel like we have a bit more ownership over the look of something, which is, I think, great for every texture painter. Right. You really start to feel like you're involved. But just to have a better sense about what was going on, like, a lot of the time a texture painter will send their textures to the farm to get published.
Right.
And then look dev will pick it up, and they don't really know how that stuff is getting used.
It's the same problem between lighting and compositing, right?
Right.
So a lighting compositor actually worked together more closely. They actually, like, here's a bunch of lighting elements. Like, well, how am I supposed to assemble this? They're like, I don't know. You just, add, you know, like, and then there's a, when things go wrong, there's one finger points at the other finger.
Right? Absolutely.
So absolutely. If you can take your textures and you know what's supposed to be used, how they're supposed to be used, then yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It used to happen a lot more in the commercial side of things, the DD, but it wasn't, it really wasn't until Avengers that they were feeling a bit more comfortable with the work being done, the look dev stuff being done in textures.
Yeah.
And we were pretty lucky. Like, we just had Darren Hendler and Jeremy, who were on our side from the very beginning.
Yeah.
They're like, you want to do this? Let's do it. You know, what's stopping us?
And Jeremy Butel, who I've known, I've worked with him, obviously, before, and he's a really good look dev artist.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah. So
one of the best.
He is. And so, but he gave you a lot of the keys to do that, right?
He was my mentor, and I worked with him previously on a few other shows
as well. What shows did he work with him on?
Mostly, I think Ender's Game was the big one.
Yep.
He spent a long time working on some of the giant ships, so I did textures for him. But just talk to him. Like, he's just been my go-to guy. He's somebody that has very massive understanding of everything, really.
Right.
But especially a look dev. And he knows how stuff physically works in the real world.
Yep.
So he'll look at your shading, and he'll tell you exactly why something's not working and point you in the right direction.
Yeah.
So for me, he was kind of the guy I was leaning on in the beginning.
Yeah. He's also... he's also unbelievably patient.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was... little side, I went just before coming to SIGGRAPH, I went on vacation, and I did some fly fishing in Montana.
Awesome.
And I met this guy who was my fishing guide, who was showing me around and stuff. The thing that I noticed the most about a fly fishing guide is he is the most slow moving person ever.
Right.
Purposefully, to make no mistakes and just to make everything slow down. And Jeremy seems like the guy who's like, just take it down a notch.
Yeah.
Let's see what's going on. No panic about this.
Yeah.
All right. How are we going to solve this problem? Okay. Like, you know, like if crap goes completely wrong, someone goes like, right? It's like me getting my fly knot like completely messed up. And like, he would just go like, all right, I got two ways to do this. I can either untangle this knot or I can just cut it off and put a new fly on. And just think about the method.
Absolutely,
And that's the way I feel like Jeremy is, too. He's a very calm person.
It's almost like kind of disarming to begin with.
Yes, it is.
He's like, whoa, like, you know, crap's really hit the fan, and yet you're not reacting the way I'm expecting you to. Nope. It's just like, well, let's just look at this. I'll just check your pulse to see if you're
still... No, but it's great because I work, you know, above him at the same time. I was like, he's cool, man. Yeah. He's awesome. He's great.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a really important skill to have, is to be able to make that happen and understand what the roles are and how to actually put everyone at ease, because look development is not something that can be done quickly.
No, not at all.
Especially on the level of where you're doing something like Thanos, right?
Sure, yeah.
And then the only problem you get into that is that you don't know when to stop, because you could go down to the atom level, right?
Absolutely.
You got pretty close to that, though.
We did, but I think we got some very good luck early on, and that was that Marvel liked what we were doing.
Right.
So we weren't like trying
to... So you were encouraged.
We were encouraged, but we also knew we were going in the right direction. Like, they went like, we're not sure about the skin color. I'm not sure about this skin surface.
Right.
They were giving us the thumbs up from the beginning.
Right.
It was just very subtle notes that they were asking us to change stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so we just felt a bit more secure as a studio that we were doing the right thing.
Well, that's awesome. Okay, one more. Let's go back, because you saw all that stuff. What was your breakthrough moment? What got you into visual effects? How did you see that thing happening?
I mean, there was a few things that happened. One of them was, like, Lord of the Rings, obviously, was big.
But that's influenced you. But that's what was your job? How did you get into it?
ZBrush came out at the same time as I was just graduating school. And so for the first time, I was that first generation of guys that was like getting to use ZBrush to create creatures. I never had any other experience but ZBrush, really. So I was sculpting before I was doing the whole NURBS or polymodeling stuff.
Good. Yes, yes, yes.
And so it was a lot more of a creative sort of piece of work than it was previously.
Yeah, and I didn't... When I got into visual effects, it was just the transition for visual effects where they started to model creatures from NURBS to polys.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? Right. And when they were still modeling creatures with NURBS, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? Yeah. It was insane that it would take this long to do anything.
It just didn't look creative. You just had to be a master technician to kind of get that stuff.
It was
stuff
like
to look
trying
like.
To say, I'm going to quilt a character.
Exactly. Little patches.
Little patches. Yeah. I'm going to quilt an entire character. Yeah. And then polys obviously made things easier, etc. But then ZBrush came around, and I saw the workflow, and this was actually, Nick, who's the concept artist at DD? I don't know if he's still around.
Oh, let me think. Nicholas Lloyd, probably,
Nick Lloyd,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was the one who introduced me to ZBrush, like, when it first came out, and he's like, check this out. I'm like, whoa, how are you doing that? He goes, and I can do levels of detail. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't even see the polygons.
Yeah, yeah.
And that concept to me was like different level, right?
Yeah.
And then it was the first time I actually saw the lump of clay, right?
Right.
I saw the lump of clay being sculpted.
Yeah.
And then I saw like, I got the lump of clay, but then I can mirror the lump of clay. I can use the CG to my advantage, but still think of it as a lump of clay.
And I kind of wonder if maybe people's, like, the public's perception of visual effects would be different if it started that way. You know, like, it sort of seems like it's a bunch of nerds on computers. Unending sort of perception of guys that work in visual effects.
I cannot agree with you more, and it's very frustrating because the problem is a lot of people say, oh, it's just done on computers.
Yeah.
No, someone is actually doing this on a computer, and the amount of effort it takes to sculpt that on a computer is as much as doing it on a lump of clay, except you don't get your fingers as dirt.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you do get carpal tunnel syndrome. You do have all the other problems that can happen with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they say, oh, it was much better when it was miniatures, it goes to a point.
Mm.
But you can, like, but when you see a giant scene in, like, Game of Thrones, it's a massive set extension.
Yeah.
All those houses are modeled. Someone modeled all those things just like they modeled a miniature.
You don't even notice half the stuff you're seeing.
You don't notice
it's digital.
Right. So I agree. And I've had a whole thing about this whole thing, like that visual effects doesn't get enough credit for the creativity and the detail that goes into these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, work like your work, and even work like Ian Spriggs' work as well.
Sure, yeah.
You know Ian as well? You know
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a big fan of his. Okay. He's great.
Well, he's actually been in town, so I've actually been hanging out with him.
You know the biggest compliment I ever got with Thanos? It was a Reddit post where they were talking about a screenshot of his hands. And half the people on the Reddit post were saying, no, they're real. They're real hands. That's Josh Brolin's hands. I've just color corrected them.
Right.
It's like, so you don't even know what you're looking at, right?
No. Yeah. But isn't that kind of the shitty part of our job? Because if we do our job 100% correctly, then no one notices it.
Well, also our job is to make something look as real as possible. Like, if you go back and look at Ghostbusters, all those great, you know, practical things, they had a personality to them, but they don't look like realistic. There's no like skin simulation or anything like that. It's all latex. And it's a romantic idea of something.
It is a romantic idea.
Yeah.
I went back to look at Terminator 1.
Yeah.
And, you know, stop motion.
Quite a bit of latex there.
Yeah, there's a lot of latex.
And it's like, I love it, but it's because I saw it in the 80s. You know, I've got a feeling attached to it.
Yeah.
It's a nostalgia.
I could not agree with you more. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. There is things where, like, oh, you don't know it's CG? Like, the problem is, like, people say, I don't like CG. It's like, no, you don't like bad CG.
Right.
Because bad CG is noticed.
And they always bring up Scorpion King or something that came out, like, 10 or 15 yeah. years ago. I was yeah. just like, well, of course, the evolution of effects is just...
Right, yes.
It just gets better with time. Mm-hmm. I think eventually it won't be such a big deal.
Right.
Like,
thank you.
Even this, you know, this generation of kids that are going to the movies, they've grown up with CG. It's not like they're comparing it to analog, I don't think, as much.
You know, it's weird because, like, my kids, my daughter's 12, and she actually criticizes CG. She goes, "Oh, that looks pretty good."
Yeah.
She does, but okay. she doesn't know what I do that much, honestly, mm-hmm. enough to, like, they actually, like, critique it on their own. Like, wow, that looks. But they don't use the term, like, special effects anymore.
Yeah.
She was using, like, that's really great CGI.
Okay.
So, but okay. Now,
are they recognizing it as being CGI because it's impossible that it's not CGI?
They're I don't think they know that.
Okay. So it's not like they're looking at Game of Thrones and being able to differentiate something that could be a set or...
There's so much is actually CG, though.
Yeah.
That it's hard to even, like, you could be watching some sitcom mm. and the whole entire background could be CG.
Right, yeah.
And totally. People don't realize that.
yeah, you know? Yeah, totally.
And it happens a lot.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
That's interesting, though. Like, because even, like, my girlfriend's mom can tell if something's CG. Like, something I worked on a few years ago, it was a baby.
But what you and I do is much more obviously CG.
I think so, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's got to be, right? It's like, what else could it be? Yeah.
So my wife's a flame artist, and she does a lot of flame effects, right? So her whole job is like, no, we were never here.
Right. You know?
Like, it is like, seriously, like, we were never here. Like, a wire removal or something happened or some fixing some problem. Whatever. Like, she's, like, all of the stuff that she does, like, we never knew it was there, right?
Right.
You work on Thanos, I work on giant robots or whatever. That's, yeah. like, that's what we do. It's like... Obviously, that was not real.
It looks great, but Thanos, no one looks like a scrotum chin guy.
but it was, it's a challenge to do that. But he was amazing. He was really good, and I think it was really important to do that.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
I, like I said, it's just like a lot of people are really passionate and just... every day just bringing it to the table,
right,
just not slacking off one bit, mm-hmm. just we had to make this amazing,
yeah,
because we want that kind of work, right? Like, that's the kind of stuff we want to keep working on,
right,
if we can.
All right, but let's, so what was your first job in the visual effects? Was it in Australia?
My first paid job was actually in West Australia.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Perth?
It was in Perth. It was for a little studio. Like, I'm talking about a two-person studio called Wiz Digital.
Uh-huh.
They were working on a TV show called The Breakfast Club.
Wait, was it related to The Breakfast Club movie?
No.
Okay.
No, it was a book series. Okay. Nothing to do with... Yeah. And in it, a girl was to transform into a goblin. And I'm not sure how they got in contact with me. I guess that they might, like, one of their friends must have known me for some reason.
Right.
I can't quite remember. But I was just like, I'll do it. No problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
Your first job, you'll do whatever.
I've never rigged in my life. Never animated.
Fake it till you make it.
But I'd done some modeling. Like, they probably seen a few models that I'd done.
Okay.
And so I was pretty confident that I could at least...
What were you using at the time?
I was using Maya.
Okay.
Using ZBrush and Maya, Photoshop. And that was basically it. Just rendering in a mental ray, I think. Whatever came with Maya.
Yep.
And so I just killed myself. I spent 2 weeks, didn't sleep pretty much. And just bought a few books on how to rig and animate. And like all that.
Yeah.
And that was it. Like, I took that on the delivery day. I didn't ask for an extension. I drove it there at like 8 o'clock in the morning. Hadn't slept for a couple of days.
Right.
And I was like, all right, here you go. I'm like, oh, thanks.
Yeah. And that's, you got your first taste of like, oh crap, this is a hard job.
Yeah. Well, it was just exhilarating. Like, right. I just was like, I'm doing it. This is it. This is going to be in a TV show.
Yeah. You know? I get it. Yeah. I totally get it.
Yeah, it was just, and it was like, it was character work. It wasn't just doing little background props or something. It was like, wow. Yeah. So, I mean, that just gave me a taste for it, and it gave me the confidence that I could pull it off as well.
Sure.
And so, at that point, I was like, I got to get out of Perth. Like, I can't stay here and just do, like, little commercials and TV show stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was kind of looking around a little bit.
Yeah.
I was either going to move to Vancouver or I was going to go to Sydney. And I've got family in Sydney.
Okay.
But my dad is from Canada, and so I was actually born in Saskatchewan.
Okay.
He went to vet school out there.
All right.
So I had a Canadian passport, and at the time there wasn't. This is 2007. There wasn't really much going on in here in Vancouver.
Okay.
But more than that was going on in Perth, anyway.
Sure.
Yeah, and I had friends here as well.
Okay.
So that was kind of my deciding factor. I was like, I'm going to just try Vancouver. I had about $2,000 in my account. Got a ticket.
Yeah.
And came over here and just sort of started peddling my wares.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you just walked around with a demo reel and see
pretty
who
much. I went to every networking event I could find.
Yeah.
Started talking to people that were, a lot of them were teaching at the Art Institute at the time, or VFS.
Uh-huh.
And I was actually big fans of some of these students that have been putting their VFS reels online. And I'm still friends with them to this day.
Right.
People like Marco Menko and Juliana Kalakis. These are the artists that did the prawns in District 9.
Yeah.
I was just in awe of their stuff. And so I just kind of sent the messages on, you know, Facebook or whatever.
But so that was really great, because back then you basically had a network of people that you kind of knew.
I made a network.
You made a network.
Kind of. Right. I didn't know these people from Adam, but I would just show up to networking events that I knew they were going to be there. I was like, I love your stuff. I saw your reel a couple years ago. And then, you know, you just strike up a friendship. And that's kind of how you get jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. And a lot of it is, I know a guy.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a small enough industry that I know a guy makes a difference.
Yeah.
Right? You don't have to be certified in a certain thing or whatever. You just, like, you have to have enough, stuff that people are going to notice you, but you also have to say, we need someone. I know someone who is good enough to do this job or better, right?
Yeah.
So that worked out. So
yeah, totally.
So what was your first job in Vancouver?
It was actually working for a TV animation studio called Bardell Entertainment.
Uh-huh.
So they were working on something called Viva Piñata, which was originally a game that they were turning into a TV show.
Okay.
And I found very quickly it wasn't my cup of tea. Like, feature animation, no, not for me.
Really?
Yeah.
Or broadcast animation.
Broadcast animation, actually.
Right.
Yeah, that's probably right. And so I started looking around for another job. And I would go home and then work till 4 in the morning and keep developing my skill set. I was still building more characters and trying to learn some V-Ray and things like that. And so eventually, one of my friends from Perth had moved over to start working at Spin. So Spin Visual Effects.
Okay.
They're mostly based in Toronto.
All right.
But about 10 years ago, they had a studio here in Vancouver.
Okay.
And I really wanted to get in there.
Okay.
It was just like my number one goal. Like, there wasn't a lot of studios. It wasn't the Vancouver we know today with every single, you know, studio under the sun.
Yeah.
We had Rainmaker, that was the big one, which is now Method.
Yeah.
And MPC hadn't opened yet.
Image Engine was here, though. Right?
Image Engine was here, but they were mostly working on TV.
Yeah.
This was just at the breaking point where everything just blew up. The tax subsidy got larger, and then we had NBC open up, and then from Digital Domain, and that, you know, as you know, it's just like the hub. So I got very lucky. I kind of came at the right time.
You came here just as the crest.
Pretty much, yeah.
Right.
So Spin was my first studio that was actually a film visual effects house. It was the first time I was actually, you know, working on with live action on a film sort of related.
Okay.
Project, as well as doing some TV stuff as well.
Right.
And at the time, they were kind of they'd shrunken down a lot. They just finished Outlander, which was not a successful film.
Okay.
And I think they had invested money in it, and it didn't do too well, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
So they were just kind of getting whatever they could, whatever sort of scraps they could for TV shows mostly.
Right.
So I was the only model or texture there.
Okay.
And we were just doing a lot of pitch work, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I just loved it. It was fantastic. Like, to me, that was just like, oh man, I made it.
Right. even though the company was struggling to stay alive.
They were barely staying afloat, and they didn't, to be honest.
Right.
Like, I probably was there for about 6 months, and they were just like, we're sorry, we don't have enough work to kind of keep you around.
Wow.
But thankfully, I'd worked on so much stuff while I was there.
You had plenty of assets, right?
I did, yeah. But I lots of TV show stuff. I could make a little demo reel. That wasn't just my personal work anymore. It was actually production stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, that's when I made the jump to Method.
Oh, okay.
So that was my big time sort of visual effects job.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you went to Method for a while. What was the big project you worked on? Method?
I was hired there to work on Invictus. So it was Clint Eastwood film.
Uh-huh.
It's like mostly background characters, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing environments too. I did like the UN building.
Okay.
So it was pretty simple stuff, wasn't too challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was just the exposure to new tools. I got to learn a bit of, you know, Houdini, a bit of RenderMan, that kind
of
stuff.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that's it. I was still working on my own stuff at home. I was still trying to develop my skill set.
Yeah.
And
don't you?
I still do, yeah.
Yeah.
I still do. I still find it fun.
Yeah, it's good.
There's still new stuff to learn.
Yeah.
So I kind of like... started talking to Miguel Ortega at this time.
Oh, I know Miguel.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because he did the Nino project with
us. Exactly, but yeah. Like back when I first started, he'd been working on Underworld. He had a really good demo reel out of Noman, I think.
Yeah.
But he put together this great creature reel.
Uh-huh.
And it was mostly like Underworld and whatever projects they were working on at Cafe Effects.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And so I started to talk to him a little bit, and then he told me he was coming up to Vancouver to work at Digital Domain.
Okay.
And so that kind of seemed like that was probably a good thing to sort of see if I could get in there.
Yeah.
And so kind of, you know, advocated for me to join the modeling texturing team, and that's how I ended up on Thor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
And that was about 8 years ago. Maybe a little bit longer now.
That was about 8 years ago. Yeah. But you and I worked on a couple of projects together. I'm trying to think back which ones we worked on together. Did you work on Maleficent?
Never touched. I wasn't on Maleficent. I was busy on Ender's Game. I think back
Ender's
that
Game.
Time.
Yeah. Were we on a project together?
Hey, I'm trying to think back. We must have been on something.
47 Ronin.
I was not on that.
I was on
Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh my God, Jack. Wow, yeah, that was a crazy film.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of textures on that one.
Oh, boy.
It was UDIM City.
Yeah. And well, that was our first project using Mari.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, I mean, that...
And that what shocked me is that the texture painters needed graphics cards that were more powerful than anyone else.
Yeah.
Because of the whole Mari pipeline
and the UDIM pipeline. Right. It was a real steep learning curve for us.
Right.
But, you know, this is when I was getting, I was really getting interested in what makes something look real.
Like, okay.
Like, trying to analyze it. It's not the color. It seems to be more the displacement. But I can't sculpt that level of detail. But this is, like, around the time, I think, Avatar came out, 2009.
Yeah.
Around there. And I started to, listened to a few of these Seagraph presentations by Gino Acevedo over at Weta. And he was talking about this amazing technique that they developed to get, like, poor detail, where they'd taken a plaster cast of an actor, or just anybody, really, and they put, like, a very fine layer of silicon on the surface of it, taken that off, like, really thin, millimeter thickness, and then put it on a flatbed scanner that had about an inch of baby oil on the surface of it. And they were scanning these and then just grayscaling them. And they were using this as like a fine height map to generate like all the pore detail in Avatar. I was like, this is amazing. I'm like, who would have thought of this? This is crazy.
It is, you're right, because most of the detail comes from normals, not from color.
Absolutely.
Right.
You should be able to get something looking real in grayscale. You shouldn't need any color information in it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And that's the thing. That's what I always think is the most important thing, is get the displacement, the fine displacement right,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of it is, you know, just the cherry on top.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a lot of ways. Obviously, the scatter matters a lot too, but you can just get 90% of the way there with a really good displacement.
I have found when I'm working with the Wikihuman data and I'm looking at it that the diffuse element is actually fairly trivial.
Right, yeah.
You know, if you know what the depth map is supposed to be, it's like, it's pretty trivial, right? Like, you can do that. What really matters is the specular map.
Yeah.
And the specular map is all about roughness, and that roughness is all about geometry.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And so the finer the detail, the better. Because even... if I, like, I'm looking at you now, and you're like, you know, about a meter and a half away from me, but there's so much of the detail of your skin is coming through based on roughness.
Yeah.
And if you can do that all in geometry, it's way better than trying to fake it with a roughness map or anything else.
Which is a fake anyway.
It is a fake. It is trying to simulate something that is, you know, trying to work. Because you can use a GGX shader to simulate roughness of this plastic or your head.
Yeah.
If I say I use the GGX BRDF for both, but that's plastic and that's your head. that's a different roughness.
Right.
So I can't use the same, you know, like 0.8, 0.8. Like, no, your skin is different than this plastic,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
And so if you can get that roughness as geometry, then it's going to look more real, absolutely. Well, alright, what are your thoughts about the future of digital human work and digital character work from this point forward now? Because obviously you've gone down to the nitty gritty on terms of a lot of stuff and down the rabbit hole, which you seem to enjoy.
Yeah, it is really fun.
Yeah. But what do you think about, like, past this? What's the future of digital character work? What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to, like... it's a really hard question. I mean, like, even with Thanos, there's probably stuff that we could go back and make better.
Sure.
You know?
Well, what would you make better?
Like, even... I think even the scanning techniques that we use, like using the skin scans, they could even be a little bit higher fidelity.
Okay.
I mean, one of the big problems I find is always distance from the character. Like, when you get nice and close, it really shows all that work off. But whenever the character gets further away from camera, it starts to get a little too slick. And there's definitely things you can do in the rendering side of things.
Do you think that's
the
renderer that does that?
I'm not sure. It could be the filtering of the textures. I'm not sure. The MIP mapping. It's always been the bane, I think, of characters. It's like they can look really good at a certain distance, but tend to lose fidelity.
I agree with you. And I think there's something a little bit different level, right?
Okay.
Because people tend to focus on the micro, which is a good thing to do because it does bring out all the things that we just discussed. But there's sometimes when you pull back from a character and then suddenly it breaks.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know necessarily if it's the rendering that's the issue or there is a macro problem that has been ignored, right?
Yeah.
Because filtering, I agree, can break it things, right? And I think Fernando Brog is like, when you're getting to that level and you want to try to break things, like, mid-mapping can actually do you a disservice.
Yeah.
When a character... It'll be fine for a car or a couch or whatever.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
For character skin, it'll do you a disservice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, sometimes a character will not look real if you take them out and blur them, right? In the same way that I had this conversation with this person about digital humans, and she and I were talking over video Skype, and it was highly compressed video Skype.
Okay.
And I was looking at her, and it's like, I'm looking at your video right now, and there's all kinds of compression artifacts, but I know you're human.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So what is that then?
There's a little bit of proportions. Like, I think people get immediately close up. They don't take the time to go back up
and
sculpt it based on the macro look, right? Sometimes, you know, like your eyes are a little... When I was at Digital Domain and we were working on a project which never came out and the actor was never revealed, but anyway, this specific actor who's considered one of the most handsome people around, and we got a digital scan of these people, of this actor, and we're like, whoa, his left eye is like... almost like a full eye higher than his right eye.
Really?
Like very disproportionate. Mm. Like highly disproportionate. Mm. And there's all kinds of things that were wrong with his face if you were to analyze it that way.
Asymmetry going on.
Big time asymmetry. Mm. But I think that the asymmetry in his specific case made him very handsome.
Really?
Right?
This is interesting.
And so I think if you tried to make him symmetrical, he would look weird.
Like too generic or
something. Too generic or something strange about
it. It's the nuances that are making him handsome.
Right. So I think there's a macro thing, like, you know, like, and honestly, I'm just saying it's from an analytical point of view. Your right eye is higher than your left eye, right? By probably about a quarter eye level, but it looks completely natural. If I actually put your eyes at the same height, I think it would look a little too CG.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
I think there's a macro level that you don't see. Just at the same level that, you know, you go close up and you see all the roughness, right?
Yeah.
There's a, as much as you need to go in and see all the pores, you need to pull back and see all the imperfections.
Right.
The same imperfections that are happening on the macro and the micro level. That's my feeling.
Like, the things I've talked to, like, as a bit of a post-mortem after Thanos, especially with talking to Jeremy again, like, it seems like what we really need to do is focus a lot more on the mid-frequency details. Because we got the fine details down pretty good.
Right.
But it's just more like, it's, when you're looking at the face as a base shape, it's just all these different levels of frequencies that all need to get to marry each other, all the way down to the very fine macro level.
Right.
And if you miss a step, if there's a bit of neglect somewhere between the general shape all the way down to the macro, something looks off.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's where you can always make something look better, is trying to find where it's breaking apart. You know, maybe it's that somewhere between the base sculpt and the pore detail. It's just it just needs something else to kind of just make it look more dimensional in some way.
Yeah. Yes. Symmetry and perfection is actually not beautiful.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Imperfection is what's beautiful, right? Yeah. And I think imperfection is what makes us look more interesting or whatever. Like, it's what gives us intrigue, you know?
Right.
Like,
personality.
You know, personality,
yeah.
Right? And so all those things that are the way that I think that it gives us an emotional connection to people, and that exists at multiple levels along the way. Right?
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
When you look at a photograph of a really old person, right?
Yeah.
And you see all the pore imperfections and the wrinkles, et cetera, et cetera. And this could be just based on how we are. You immediately feel a comfort level. Because you feel like this person has a lot of stories to tell or whatever it is, you know what I mean? So, imperfections are an intrigue to them, right?
Yeah.
Modeling a baby is actually really hard.
Oh, I know. I've done it.
You've done it, right?
Yeah, yeah. And not my most proudest moment.
Right.
I've done it twice, actually.
Really?
It's the hardest thing to get right.
Yes.
Trying to sell a realistic baby is just a thankless task.
Yeah. And then you got the peach fuzz.
It's easier to make Thanos than it is to make a baby.
There you go.
Can be
that's
the catchphrase.
Amazing. That could be, yeah, that could be the catchphrase. It's easier to make Thanos than to make a baby.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been the thing that's, like, I've had two projects where I've worked on babies, and one of them I worked on it for a good 9 months. Like,
yeah.
A very, very involved project for the baby.
Yeah.
And I hated it. Every minute I hated it. It was just, I couldn't get anything right in my mind. I couldn't get the eyes right. I sculpted multiple versions of it.
And a baby that doesn't look right is very disturbing.
Like, I think I started telling you, I worked on a film, I won't say what it is.
Okay.
But my girlfriend's mother saw it on Netflix the other day. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell her that I worked on it. And when the baby came up, she's like, oh, what a cute CG baby. What am I doing? You just killed me. Really? I was like, I can't even fool her. She's, you know, she's the general public.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just.
But don't feel bad about that, because I always had this feeling that, like, if when you do something, okay, so my oldest feeling is that if you and I, if general visual effects film, if an explosion looks wrong to you and I, we can call out everything that's wrong with that.
Yeah.
General public never sees anything wrong with it, right?
It's true.
But if a baby looks wrong, you could have the biggest PhDs in the industry trying to solve this problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, your girlfriend's mother will still see it as a problem.
You know? Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the problem with characters.
Yeah. It's the holy grail, I think, of visual effects.
Holy grail. All right. Maybe this should be the next Wiki Human Project to make
out,
a baby.
I am looking out for a convincing baby.
A convincing baby.
Oh, my. I'm not talking about in the womb. I'm talking about a fresh baby. Just, it has...
No. Like someone, like a baby that's like 3 months old.
Even that.
Yeah.
That would be fine.
It's got the peach fuzz.
Yeah.
It's got the ling. It's got the little... beautiful eye, you know, the ones that people make the pictures of.
Sure, yeah, the calendar baby.
The calendar baby, Gerber baby, a Gerber baby CG.
It shouldn't be that hard. I mean, you can can't even barely see the pore detail. I mean, it's not on that.
The subsurface is so hard on that.
Oh, it's just. I felt like such a failure.
Yeah, it's so hard.
I was so glad to go to Power Rangers after that one, because I was working on like mud characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, that's it. I think we figured out our biggest challenge right now.
I think so.
Let's babies.
I just want to ask you about one thing, because, like, when I saw Blade Runner, that's like 2049.
Yes.
What did you think of Rachel?
That's a hard question. I don't know if I can answer all that.
Really?
I think she looked pretty good.
Okay. As far as like the benchmark for digital humans in a film,
I don't think she met that.
Really?
I don't think she met that.
I was pretty blown away. As long as she didn't open her mouth, I thought it was like pretty amazing.
Okay, she didn't open her mouth, but here's the thing, right? I love the movie so much. Mm. I actually really love 2049.
An amazing film.
The fact that she didn't feel real to me was the same emotional reaction that he got.
Yeah,
he rejected her.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. It was very in keeping with the theme of the film.
Right. So I embraced it as part of that narrative.
Right. Didn't even get the eyes right.
Right? Like, yeah, you didn't get the freaking mouth motion right. You know, like there's something. Right. Well, they did a really good job. Now, I know all the challenges they had to deal with, and they've absolutely embraced the work. Mm. So, but at the same time, I was like at that moment, right?
See,
but I still felt I liked it. Mm. I liked it because it felt within the dialogue and the plot, right?
Right. Yeah.
So if she looked 100% real, it's not the same thing, right? And I say the same thing for Battle Angel, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because Battle Angel.
This is a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, let's keep going, all right?
Yeah.
So Battle Angel, to me, a lot of people hate it.
Yeah.
But I love it.
Yeah.
Honestly speaking, and because I was talking to a friend of mine who's working over at Weta, who I used to work at DD, and he's like, a lot of people hate it. No one's going to like this film. And he didn't really say that. But like, I really am excited about Battle Angel because I feel that her, let's call it uncanny valley-ness, is actually part of the plot.
Hmm.
Because she is a robot.
Yeah.
And a robot, her falling into the I'm not quite human thing,
yeah.
It makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Her eyes are a little bit distorted.
With, they're probably double the size of a
double
human
the
eye.
Size of a human eye.
Yeah.
But like you can't like some people is like, well, people. The irony is, if you look at some of the comments about the thing, it's like, well, they didn't get this right. They should have just gone to Weta to get this done.
That's hilarious,
right? It's like, and it's like James Cameron would have got this. Like, James Cameron is the executive producer on this. Trust me.
Yeah.
He had an eye on this film.
Well, people always know what they're talking about.
Yeah, no, they have no idea what they're talking about. But I think there was, to me, when I saw it, I'm like, oh, embrace the Uncanny Valley as part of a plot point.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I see her character as
very similar to how you perceive the Blade Runner plot, right?
I do.
Rachel and Blade Runner.
Rachel and Blade Runner, like, well, with Battle Angel, I see her as, like, clearly part of the Uncanny Valley. With Rachel, I see her, like, trying really hard to be human, but, it's just not quite there in some cases. It's when she speaks that obviously ruins it for me.
But I just thought they got her like as a sculpt, as a still image.
No question.
Pretty amazing. You know, like, I don't feel like they ever got that kind of level with any of that Rogue One stuff, with Tarkin or Princess Leia. It didn't even come close, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, like, listen, we're talking about the same company that did, digital character for Paul Walker, right?
That's Weta, right?
That's Weta.
Yeah.
And that...
Yeah. That's pretty phenomenal.
Pretty flawless.
Yeah, right? I agree. Yeah.
So that is not a plot point. That's like, oh shit, he died, we got to fix him, right?
Yeah.
And they did a beautiful job. So if they can do that, so that there's a little bit of debate there in terms of what's going on. And I think that Weta definitely has the chops to do it. So when it came to 2049, I'm not making excuses for her. Yeah. I just feel like she wasn't quite there. And I saw that as part of me looking through his eyes. Like, she's not quite there, right? Mm-hmm. But even when I go back to the original film, she was not quite there. Sean Young was a weird character in that film.
Absolutely, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think you're supposed to think she is a replicant.
Right.
But she is.
She is, right?
And I guess the replicants have to have a little bit of more nuance to them to kind of differentiate them from your average Joe.
Right. Well, what is your opinion about the Uncanny Valley?
I feel like it just depends on which period of time you're looking at. Like, it seems to be gradually evening out.
Yeah.
You know, if you compare, like, what's the first few examples of digital humans?
Well, let's go to,
Benjamin Button.
Final Fantasy.
Final Fantasy, right?
Right.
It's just, like, already we're like...
We're way
ahead. A huge leap,
absolutely.
From that.
Yeah, but
It seems to gradually get better, and I think, like, technology is on our side.
Sure.
Every year we seem to find something that just gives us a little bit more edge, but it's a slow crawl. It doesn't all come at once.
I have been seeing this technology and art thing, right?
Right.
So technology helps you get to a certain point. It only goes so far.
Yeah.
Right? And then you look at the work of, like, Ian Spriggs, right?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, but he's like, playing on a different level.
Yep.
And he uses very little... He's taking less advantage of the technology unless it's just part of
it's
the
interpretation,
package. Right? Yeah. So he's like, oh, so somehow just being an artist has enough leverage to get you to that other point level,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There is a lot of going on in that area. I actually am fascinated by the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, I can tell.
Not because I want to get over it, because most people want to get over it. I'm actually interested in why it exists in the first place, right?
Sure.
There was a question that came up on Ian's talk, because Ian spoke for us at V-Ray Days, and it's a guy who I know who works for the Max Planck Institute, and he was like, your stuff is so good that I want to take it and remove things from it to see where it breaks, scientifically speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
So look at an Ian Spriggs sculpture or a rendering and, like, start to take things away to see which parts of it, scientifically speaking, made it take it from outside the valley to inside the valley.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think a lot of it is perception as well.
It is.
Like, you'll find people that will find something completely realistic.
Sure.
And the same another person that's looking at that will not find it quite as realistic. They'll be able to sort of dissect it a little bit more, a bit more of a tuned eye.
I don't know. I think with humans, I think it's I think it's the, here's what I've noticed, and I may be wrong, but this is what I've noticed specifically. Like, if something doesn't look realistic, everyone immediately agrees it doesn't look realistic.
Yeah.
All they know is not realistic.
Right.
When you ask them why, that's when things go tits up.
Sure,
right.
Yeah,
like,
because
when you ask them why, like, I've looked at a shot from the thing that was clearly like in the Uncanny Valley somewhere, like, but really, 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 really good, but like in the Uncanny Valley, right? So let's say from Tron, right? It's, okay. It's shots in Tron where you, like, Jeff Bridges looks really freaking good,
yeah,
but you're like, something's not right. Yeah. And I ask everyone what it is,
yeah,
and I get from the experts in the area to people like your grandmother, and everyone has a different answer. It's like, it's the chin, it's the eyes, it's the forehead, it's this. No one can agree on what it is.
Yeah.
But they all have a very strong opinion about what it is.
Right.
But it's never, they never agree. They all agree that it's wrong, but yeah, no one can ever agree what the problem actually is. And that's the thing that I think is fascinating to me. Like, oh, that's fascinating, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because we, my whole thesis about, like, why we are so good, we are, from birth,
yeah,
experts at the human face.
Yeah.
And the reason we're experts at the human face is, like, when my daughter was born, right, and she was came out of the womb, it was terrifying, and like, oh my God, I'm a dad, right? The first thing that this baby did after she stopped crying from the traumatic experience of being born was to stare at my face, right? Because that's what babies do. They stare at faces, and they recognize a pattern. And a pattern is two eyes, nose, mouth, right? They, like, know this pattern, right? Mm. Which is, by the way, when their babies are crawling around, they crawl towards a plug because it looks like two eyes and a nose. So that,
really?
Yeah, yeah. It's a pattern recognition.
So they're just looking for face shapes.
They're looking for face shapes. Wow. So if you go to a restaurant, like, for example, and you see a baby in a restaurant, the baby isn't looking at flowers. They're looking at faces. If you look around, the baby just stares at faces, face, 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 right? The reason they're staring at faces is they're looking for threat, not threat. Right?
Wow. Such a primitive kind of
it's
reaction.
Absolutely. Yeah. It should be. Like, a baby is vulnerable, absolutely vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
So if something looks threatening, they're going to cry to make sure that whatever parent, specifically mother, would protect them from threat, right?
Yeah.
Like, this person is diseased and is going to kill me, cry, protect me, right? Mm. So what's the first reaction we do as an adult is look at a baby and don't go, rah! You know, we don't do that to a baby, right? We do like, ooh, right? We actually try to make the baby feel at ease,
right,
and say we don't look like a threat.
Yep.
So we have come to recognize something that looks good and healthy and non-threatening to not threatening. This is built into our DNA from birth, right?
Yeah.
This is stuff we've studied more than anything else.
Mm.
So when something doesn't look quite right, like the Uncanny Valley, then that makes us feel uncomfortable. That makes us feel like it's diseased, and et cetera, et cetera. So
the question for me is like, how did they get... When I watch Fast and the Furious, like, it looks like Paul Walker. I don't really know how they do it. I've seen some of the breakdowns, but it feels like they...
I don't know how they did it, because I never spoke to them about it, but they did it right.
They did. It's just like, it works, right? Like, you don't question it. You know that that's not Paul Walker.
But they had good reference, though.
Yeah.
Right? You, when you're dealing with Thanos, you had reference of Josh Brolin, but you never had reference of Thanos. Thanos was came out of...
Right.
The imagination of the studio and you, right?
And you know what? To be honest, it is my preference to work on the Thanoses, the creatures.
Right.
Where you are selling a personality and the nuance, all these things, these qualities from a human, but you're not trying to create a realistic human. It's just such a different ballgame.
That's hard.
It's just so hard. And it's hard to get confident that you're going on the right direction. Because we don't have psychology degrees, you know. We try to analyze as best we can what makes something look real.
I don't think people with psychology degrees have really analyzed the digital, like Uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
I think that's something that is going to happen at some point. But, I don't know. I don't know. I, 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 you're right. I think there's something really fascinating about what we do. Here's a thing that I think is amazing. If you can sit there and say, okay, so I worked on a Marvel film that made, you know, lots of money, etc. But in the end, it's like, this is an entertaining, fun film, whatever, etc. Dismisses
right.
it. But the work that went into this film and the work that went into that can actually serve a massive amount of industries. The work that went into making sure that Thanos conveyed his emotions as well as possible could actually serve the psychology department, could serve the research. I believe there is a parallel between the uncanny valley and autism.
Really?
Yeah, because I think autism is that when you look at people who are autistic, they actually have a hard time understanding emotions.
Yeah.
Which is the same problem that you have, like if something doesn't look right, you freak out and you're like, no. But like, you look completely normal to me, right? But if I didn't have the ability to recognize that, everything would look like the uncanny valley to me. And therefore, as someone that's autistic, everything would look like a threat.
Yeah.
And that would be very disturbing. And I believe my thesis is that to someone that is autistic or different levels of autism, everyone looks like the uncanny valley. And that, I think, is something interesting to think about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So being able to capture fine emotions in the digital world is something that actually I think can help people to understand emotions, right? You are trying to capture, you scientifically captured fine emotions that normally they've never been captured before. So you have served this world that could actually work in a lot of different ways. So I think there's a lot to be said about that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I'm endlessly fascinated by it. I try to read as much as I can about it, too.
Right.
Like, even the work you've done with the Digital Human Group, it's like, I've definitely stolen a bit of that, you know? It's just, I kind of feel like it just is incremental, though. It's just like little developments.
Absolutely.
And just, it's almost like little groups of things you need to look into and see, like, what you can do to take it to the next level. For me, it was skin pore detail, like, or wrinkles, fine stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was what I was trying to do, because I really felt like if I could get that looking right, I could create a realistic surface. And that was my domain. Like, I wasn't involved in the animation, wasn't involved in all that kind of stuff, which had its own technologies.
Right.
But I think little by little, as these things kind of develop,
right,
we just get a little bit closer.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're ever going to cross the uncanny valley. We've come close, you know, but it's just, like you said, it's just such a huge thing to...
We've crossed it several times, but it's different every time, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, I think we crossed it when we did Benjamin Buttons, right? I think that was the first, like, gold standard to me in a lot of ways. Like, a lot of people don't realize that he was a CG character.
Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
For the time, too.
For the time, yeah, right?
It's like, you know, 10 like, years ago.
Yeah, or more. So it's really important.
Were you involved in that?
I was not at all involved in that. Mm-hmm. So, but I still see that as, like, the moment. You know, like, the moment. Because I see, like, Final Fantasy as a moment of, like, first attempt.
Yeah.
And then I see Benjamin Buttons as first execution.
Yeah.
Ironically, a lot of people did both of those projects.
Yeah.
Because they were obsessed about it, you know, several years apart. So, but yeah, I think it's an important part of it. I think what we're thinking about in terms of where digital humans are going to go is going to be good.
I honestly think that there's a lot more public interest in it, too. Like, it has a lot more implications now than it used to. You know, just as far as actors wanting to create their likeness for whatever future projects they have.
Right.
It kind of captures them at their peak.
It can, or some people are fearful of it and never want to have their capture.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, I've heard of Robin Williams had it in his will that his likeness would never be replicated. He owns the rights of his likeness.
Right.
Right? So, and that's an important thing, right?
Yeah.
So it has different things.
You're quite interested in the ethics as well.
I am very interested in the ethics,
I mean, like, I think visual effects studios will be kind of venturing into more of that dark territory.
They are. They're on the, it was interesting. I never really had a problem with Tupac.
Okay.
Because I thought the way that I saw Tupac being done through Dre and Snoop was actually very interesting, and it was about finding a way to celebrate or honor their friend.
Right. Not exploit.
Not exploit, because it wasn't being exploited, because they weren't even making money off him, because it was a surprise, right? Yeah. It was something like, we just want to bring him back somehow from the dead, and this seemed like a weird way to do it. They never thought about it. Now, then when they did it, then it was like, oh, who else can we bring back from the dead? Like, oh. What they did, I never saw as exploitive, but what they did enabled people to think about exploiting people.
Yeah,
you know
absolutely.
What I mean?
I think you're right.
Because I never thought that they were exploiting Tupac, but at the same time, we're like, oh, let's bring Tupac. Well, let's bring back Michael Jackson. Let's bring back Elvis. Let's bring back, you know, like,
What's interesting to me is that, like, not too long ago, they announced that Princess Leia is going to be in the next Star Wars film, right? So this is an actress that died a couple years ago, and they're going to have to digitally recreate her.
Unless they shot her before.
It seems doubtful that they would have enough footage to put together a film. Maybe, but I don't think so, because it's only... She died during the second film, right?
But they may have shot it. You don't know how they shot things.
You're right. They may have shot it out of order.
I don't know.
I don't know, but...
Very few people know what actually happens on Star Wars.
I think when you hear about some... you're right. But when you hear about somebody being replaced digitally, everybody kind of gets a little tense. Because you know that you're going to be having to analyze it and buy it.
Yeah. And what's funny is, like, okay, let's go back to our other thing about... what's his name? Tolkien, right? Who's the CG character? Not Leia, but...
Oh, Tarkin.
Tarkin, right? Yeah. With Tarkin, I was like, you know, a lot of people, especially on the high level, right? Remember I was saying it, like, everyone knows something is wrong?
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that saw that and thought he was a real person.
Yeah, see, I didn't for a second.
You didn't for a second, but you've also watched Star Wars before.
Yeah.
Right? So you knew what the old character looked like. And I was like, okay. So I'm sitting there like, Not real. I'm like, okay, but not real. Hmm. And so a lot of people are like, who was that guy? And you realize, like, he's not real. Like, so I think we're starting to get to that period when I said everyone knows something's wrong.
Yeah.
Now we're starting to get to the period where, like, you and I know it's wrong, but someone else may not.
Yeah.
You know, so we're actually getting to the period where we're getting more critical. And maybe your eye and my eye have gotten better in...
Well, I can't wait for a time in the future where I just can't tell.
Right.
I hope we get there.
Do you want to?
I do.
Because a lot of people are looking like, I'm terrified of the time when I can't tell.
Well, I mean, I think we're already in that weird period now where you can do so much with 2D
sure.
stuff.
Oh, yeah, with deep learning?
Yeah, that it's already... We're already in that scary place.
Oh, yeah, we're already scary.
But, I mean, I do love this industry. I do love what we've achieved as a community and as an industry.
Right.
And, you know, to completely fool me, like, I would just take my hat off to that.
Yeah, I see it.
As a technical achievement.
As someone has founded the Wiki Human Project, absolutely. Yeah. If we could figure this out, then that would make a
like,
huge...
If someone showed you a piece of footage and it's 10 minutes long and then they go, Chris... Which one is the digital human?
Right.
And you can't tell? Like, how would you feel?
Yeah, I would feel pretty good.
Yeah. It would just be like, we're there. I can't tell.
Yeah.
I just watched a nuanced performance, and I couldn't tell which one was real and which one was digital.
What would be even better is if the entire performance was synthetic, meaning never captured.
Right.
Meaning it was completely done all in the computer. Like, okay. The entire human was created completely synthetically. That would be the ultimate thing.
Yeah.
Where there was no motion capture, there was nothing. It was all derived from deep learning, from whatever analytical process.
We'll get there.
I know. Oh, yeah. Fast.
I'm pretty up to date with what's going on with deep learning. Like, we use it quite a bit.
I know.
And I'm just blown away. I'm just like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
This feels like science fiction.
It does. Because it's solving problems that we don't know how to solve.
Yeah.
By itself. Yeah. It's scary. Scary
stuff. Spuggles the mind. I just wondered how long I'm going to have a job. someone else is figuring this stuff out.
That's actually an interesting point. Because I don't think that AI is actually going to remove your job. I think it's going to make your job more fun. I actually believe that AI is going to... AI is not going to try to think of Thanos' backstory and give him the calluses on his hand.
Right.
That's coming from you. Right? And that is what you can contribute. What you can do is say, I think Thanos has a backstory and he's held a dagger in his hand and therefore he needs some calluses. And AI will put that there for you. But that's going to come from your creative part. And that goes back to those points. Because I think that that is where AI is going to help us. It's going to... AI is going to allow you not to have to unpaint shadows. Right?
Yeah.
AI will solve that for you. And you can focus on what's important.
Tool in the tool set.
It's not just a tool in the tool set. It's going to make the creative process even more important, where everything you do creatively is not just going to be skill.
Yeah.
Skill is going to be part of... it's not about dexterity in the craft.
Yeah.
It's going to be about, like, the thought process instead, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something you still have to offer us.
It's like pure creativity.
Pure creativity, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I absolutely think that artists and AI actually are not divergent. I think they're actually complementary.
Yeah.
And that's going to be hard to convince people.
I think so. It always freaks people out. And any sort of progression
of course you do. Of course, and it's right to do so.
Yeah.
That's the disruption aspect, right?
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think that's what just keeps this job exciting as well. It's just like all these, you know, I'm not sick of this industry at all. I'm not sick of this job.
Right.
I'm still finding new ways to be creative.
Right.
And contribute something, a little something, to the end result.
That's
all I really want.
Absolutely.
That's what makes it fun.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to wrap it up. We were actually almost an hour and a half. Do you believe that?
That's pretty good.
Does that feel good?
Yeah, another 27 hours to go. All right.
Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you doing this with me, Chris. And we'll do the Polaroid and we'll do everything else. And this is... I can't believe I'm doing a podcast with Chris Nichols. It's really cool.
And the fabric of reality didn't break. So
that's great.
It's Adam Furness.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris.